Case for argument is Porco versus trustees of Indiana University. Mr. Porco.
Your Honors, Counselor, may it please the Court, I'm Christopher Aldo Porco, the Plaintiff Appellant, representing myself pro se, seeking a reversal of the United States District Court of the Southern District of Indiana's judgment. In this appeal, this Court has a capacity for the first time to declare and judge the rules determining resident and non-resident student status for IU purposes unconstitutional.
Mr. Porco, yes. Let me just start you right out, because the university has argued that you withdrew your request for injunctive relief and agreed instead to hold the disputed tuition in escrow until the case was resolved. If you withdrew your request for injunctive relief and the money was transferred to the university, what possible relief could we grant you at this point?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the request for injunctive relief was withdrew, of course, because of the agreement reached, because this case represents the procedural quagmire involved with the 11th Amendment immunity. And as I stated in the brief, I believe this case is still very much alive. For if this court were to declare the rules unconstitutional and reverse the district court's judgment, the counsel for IU would no longer be entitled to costs. I would be entitled to costs of the district court's case as well as this appeal. And furthermore, as I argued...
But that argument would pretty much wipe out any sort of concept of mootness, right? A case would never be moot because you could always say that, well, if you prevailed, you would get costs, right? You know, there is this principle that the standing has to continue throughout the entire litigation, and that implies that the fact that pursuing an appeal after the case is moot might have effect on cost doesn't keep it alive.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I said in my brief, there was... the case that it said that costs ancillary to a case are allowed by 11th Amendment. So I would propose that perhaps 11th Amendment immunity would not apply in that particular scenario. But also, as I argued, I requested a stay from the district court, not knowing, of course, that the judgment was executed. And I had argued that the court had the power to rescind the action of the clerk.
Who or what led you to believe that that you were led at the time you filed your appeal that the judgment had not yet been executed?
There was nothing in the docket, for example, and if you look at the docket, it's very specific as far as what happens before that. You know, when the money was given to the court, that was mentioned. When it was given to the bank, it was mentioned. It showed where the money went. It never, ever said that the judgment was actually executed and it was done.
So is that the reason the motion to stay was filed so late?
Absolutely.
It was
filed just a few days after the judgment was executed. I had no knowledge that the judgment had been executed. Otherwise, I certainly would have filed prior to that. Absolutely. And as I mentioned, there was a Sixth Circuit case. It was a bankruptcy proceeding, but it was very similar where there was this mootness issue presented. And that case said that an appeal is not necessarily moot due to changed circumstances during an appeal. And while I realize that's a Sixth Circuit opinion, I just propose to that court that is at least persuasive.
How do you respond to the university's argument that they, in fact, grant about 75% of requests to change residence for tuition purposes? I mean, wouldn't that really destroy your argument that there's no opportunity to establish residency while still you know, while still a student, I mean, obviously quite a few people seem to have managed to convince the university of, you know, of the sincerity of their intention to remain in Indiana, even though they're still students.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, first of all, that 75% was mentioned in the affidavit by one of the parties to this action, and there's been nothing to substantiate that, no other sort of log sheet as far as voting records and whatnot. Moreover, I'm not arguing that no student is being reclassified. Certainly there are some, but I'm arguing that the rules are unconstitutional because they are not bona fide residence criteria, meaning that IU picks and chooses among legal residents who exactly gets resident student status. And in particular, there are three circumstances in which they grant that, which was revealed during depositions. Number one is foreign nationals, those who move overseas to take classes at IU, because presumably, according to IU, if they move to Indiana, that's their new domicile. Number two is students working full-time who go to school part-time. And number three, the only possible scenario that could apply to me being a full-time student born in the United States, is those who marry or intend to marry an Indiana resident. And I'd asked Joanne Bowen, the Standing Committee Residence Chair, the Associate Registrar, Tom May, as well as the Standing Committee members, you know, how many cases, reclassification cases have you sat on? And they had all sat on hundreds each. And these were the only three scenarios they could possibly come up with. So what I'm saying is students like myself who present all these other objective indicators that they have their domicile in Indiana are rejected simply because they don't fall into one of these three narrow circumstances.
But there are also lots of students who register to vote. They get a driver's license. They get bank accounts in the state. And they do that even if they don't intend to remain there after graduation, right?
I can't speak for anyone else, but I know I would not go to the Department of Motor Vehicles to get a license if I didn't intend to stay in the state, as well as register to vote, as well as file your tax returns within the state of Indiana, as well as on all loan documents, all such documents to claim your permanent residence is Indiana. I mean, like I said, I can't speak for anyone else. But when you take all these factors in total and say, well, where is the student domiciled? I mean, how could you say it would be any other state if they have really no other ties anywhere else other than family members that reside there?
Well, this business you had, didn't you have a business in Michigan? You were.
Well, first of all, Your Honor.
You had been president of the company since January of 2003.
Well, that business, Your Honor, like many e-businesses, was never actually taken off the ground. Paperwork was filed, but it never actually was up and running.
But that indicated that it was a Michigan business, right? That wasn't something that you created in Indiana.
Well, in essence, what that does is IU is asserting some sort of crystal ball defense in which they're saying that, well, their determination that I was a non-resident is justified by acts that happened in the future that they didn't even know about at the time.
I think the real point is that under your principle, any student can claim a resident status regardless of where he intends to end up. Right? It's just simple. You get a license, you do this, you do that, then you get this big tuition break, then you go off somewhere else.
Well, I mean, that's certainly possible.
How would the state possibly police its policy of providing a resident a tuition break to residents? No way to do it.
Well, I mean, there certainly are other ways to do it that other universities do, but at least the other universities.
No, how would they do it?
Well, at least
How would you suggest they do it?
Well, I would suggest a more objective process
like
than just.
What?
Well, for example, you could use certain criteria, but perhaps enumerate.
Such as?
Well, allow the criteria that are currently used, but apparently are just totally disregarded.
Criteria. Name a criterion that you regard as.
Voter registration.
Well, that's the simplest thing in the world, right? What's the big deal about voter registration? Anyone can register in another state. Getting a driver's license is a slightly bigger bother if you already have it. On the other hand, if you're going to be, you know, in a state for several years, you're supposed to get a local license.
Although there is an exception noted, which is if you're just going to be a student and if you're going to leave, you actually don't have to get a license. Uh-huh. And what I'm arguing is that not any one of these factors in particular can say that you are domiciled and stable. What I'm saying is that the totality of these, or at least when you have more on one side that say you're an Indiana resident versus any other resident, at least if you weigh these factors.
What is this? What are they? So you have the license, you have the voter registration, what else?
Again, a lot of these are actually already in Indiana University's rules. Where they get their income, where they pay their taxes, where the automobile is registered, where the driver's license is from, the residence claimed on any sort of loan application, federal income tax returns in particular, where they reside in the
but
summer, I think is particularly
easy.
Relevant.
And of course, you're a kind of perfect example of the problem, right? Because you do all these things, but then you end up in Michigan. So.
Well, I think it's important to remember, first of all, that
anyone
this is only on summary
that,
judgment,
right?
That the district court said, well, for purposes of summary judgment, we're going to agree that you're a legal resident. So really, this issue at this point, I believe, is dead in the water, and we've moved on to the substantive issue. But also
would you concede at most the last semester of tuition is what is at stake here?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it's just the last?
At most. At most, I would agree to that. Due to 11th Amendment immunity, I can't seek relief due to tuition that was paid prior to that. But getting back to your question about your statement as far as I'm a perfect example, there's a number of reasons why I disagree with that. One is that act does not equal intent, and what's important is the student's intent when they are in that state. They don't necessarily have to reside in that state forever to be domiciled in that state. A good analogy is, if you intend to run the Chicago Marathon.
There's a practical problem for these schools, which is how to prevent people from getting the tuition break when they actually have no ties to Indiana and no particular expectation of staying there realistically. They just want to have a tuition break. How do you police that?
It's obviously not a very easy procedure, but it shouldn't be the burden of a great majority of people who are actually legal residents of Indiana to shoulder the tuition load for those that IU determines who are legal residents and who are not.
So can you come up with a test that the Indiana University could use? I understand it's not your burden, but can you come up with a test? We're looking for some hook to provide a way that the schools properly identify people who really intend to be in Indiana and are entitled to that break. Can you come up with something?
Well, I would suggest that
beyond just driver's license and the three or four things you did.
Well, I mean, other than giving someone a polygraph and asking them, is it your true intent? I really don't know how you can inquire into someone's mind.
Well, that's an idea. Okay.
There you go.
Yeah, you could. Under perjury, right?
Exactly. But
prison threat.
But perhaps I'm at least suggesting that if you're going to use objective criteria, use it uniformly, and perhaps a certain number of those objective criteria should at least show that you are domiciled in state rather than another. If there are no further questions, I'm going to reserve my further time for rebuttal. Thank you,
Mr. Fickle.
You just gave us a good idea for how to fill up some of our less populous states, actually.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Indiana University's rule for qualification for in-state tuition says that you have to be a resident, in effect a domicile, of the state of Indiana for a year. It further says that physical presence in the state for the predominant purpose of attending the university does not count as residence or domicile towards the one-year period.
Isn't it possible that Mr. Porco intended to remain in Indiana from the first day of his arrival and then changed his mind again when he graduated? I mean, my problem is that subjective intent is hardly the kind of thing that we rule on as a matter of law on appeal.
Your Honor, I'd like to, first of all, make clear that the subjective intent issue here goes only to the standing issue. It does not go to the merits of, there's no real claim in this case that he qualifies under the rule as it is. And indeed, he didn't seek judicial review of the university decision, which he could have done under Indiana procedure.
Yeah,
so the subjective intent only.
Regardless, that's that's highly disputed, and it's not definitively resolved on this record by any stretch of the imagination, his subjective intent.
Okay, Your Honor, again, this goes to the standing issue.
I understand
issue.
That.
Okay. On that issue, what I would say, Your Honor, is
if the case isn't, moot, then he has standing to contest at least the predominant purpose of the test. I think it's a rather odd argument that he didn't have the subjective intent to remain, because his subsequent departure for Indiana doesn't necessarily bear on his subjective intent while he was in law school. He could have been a resident of Michigan and genuinely changed his subjective intent on entering Indiana, and then changed it again on exiting law school. So, I mean, at this stage of the proceedings, it seems to me, at any rate, that a court is obliged to take his word for what his subjective intent was in his last year of law school.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, and I would simply say it's a question of what this court and the district court's entitled to demand on summary judgment. Here, we raised this issue, we moved, we put in the evidence about what had happened, including, indeed, applying to the Michigan Bar, making the statements to the Michigan Bar before he ever graduated from law school. And the question is, what did he put in coming back in the summary judgment context? He put in an affidavit that stated that the legal conclusion that I established a domicile in Indiana. It did not say, oh, I changed my mind, I previously meant to, and try to explain those facts away. It doesn't even actually recite that he ever intended to stay in Indiana. It simply states the legal conclusion. And the issue is how strict this court is going to be in requiring specific facts to be set forth in summary judgment.
In the 75% of the cases where you grant the request for reclassification, how many of these students have continuously been enrolled as students, as Mr. Porco was when he made the request?
All I can tell you, Your Honor, is that it is not in the record. I will tell you, on the 75%, this is not an affidavit. This is Mr. Defendant May's testimony taken by Mr. Porco. If he wanted more facts, he could have asked more questions, which he didn't do. But I'd also like to make clear the 75% is those that Mr. May passes on. He's the assistant registrar at the Indianapolis campus. So he's not talking about university-wide. He's talking about the ones that he has passed on were 75%.
And you don't know what that number is?
I do not. Let
me ask you this. Short of getting married or accepting a permanent job offer in Indiana, which is not an option for all students, what could Porco have done to show he intended to remain in Indiana?
Well, the evidence is in all the facts, circumstances kind of case. But what he's got to do under the predominant purpose test is show a substantial reason for being in the state other than attending the university. He's got to make an objective showing that there's a reason why I'm here right now today that other than attending the university. And if I wasn't attending the university, I would still be here. So we're looking for a purpose. We're looking for a reason why the person is in the state for reasons other than. And I would like to say, Your Honors, that the United States Supreme Court has twice said that state has a legitimate interest in reserving in-state tuition to bona fide residents of the state. It has twice said that the state can use criteria, reasonable criteria, as to make virtually certain that a student who's not a bona fide resident of the state cannot take advantage of the in-state rates. The second time the court said that, and that's the Martinez versus Bynum case, right at that point, the virtually certain sentence, it drops a footnote. And in that footnote, it refers to the regulations, university regulations involved in earlier cases where the rule had been upheld by the district court and was summarily affirmed by the Supreme Court. One of those was the University of Minnesota regulation. It was in the Starnes case. As quoted by the Supreme Court, it says you have to have 1 year's domicile in the state of Minnesota primarily as a permanent resident and not merely as a student. The Supreme Court goes on and quotes the University of Washington rule that was involved in the Sturgis case. That one said, as quoted by the Supreme Court, that you've got to have a year's domicile in the state for purposes other than or for other than educational purposes. So there's simply no question that the Supreme Court is approving rules like that. The decision, the language of the case isn't understandable otherwise.
Do you want to say something about the jurisdictional issue, whether this appeal should be dismissed just because there's no relief that he can get?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the agreement was, in writing, it's in the record, that the money will be distributed in accordance with the final judgment of the district court. Under the rule, he had 10 days to seek a stay. He didn't do it. The court, the clerk of the court, then, pursuant to the court's order, I mean, the judgment, passed out the money. There's an 11th Amendment bar at this point, and it's 11th Amendment bar that Mr. Porco himself argued to the court, not knowing, of course, that the money had already been paid. The clerk had carried out the judgment. So, yeah, we say there is no relief.
Well, what about his argument about, I didn't really understand it, maybe you did, about costs?
Okay.
What's that about?
Yeah, Your Honor, if you look at what he says about that case, it says that the 11th Amendment does not bar the recovery of costs awarded ancillary to injunctive relief. Well, there's no injunctive relief in this case. He waived it in the very beginning. So that case has nothing to do with the situation here. I would like to say also that when you push on this a little further and say, well, why would the Supreme Court in this area allow special criteria that it may not when the issue is voting or some other state benefit? And the answer is, if you look at it, that in most situations, when somebody comes to the state, moves to the state, and says, I intend to stay here for the indefinite future, there is strong, objective, probative evidence that supports that statement. The person has picked up, has spent the time, the effort, the money to move him or herself, move property, establish a dwelling in the other state. So we have objective evidence in most situations. In the university student context, we have no such evidence. The fact that they moved and established a dwelling in the state of Indiana while they're going to school is no evidence at all of a permanent intention to stay, because every student who comes has to do that. In addition, in the ordinary case, as well as the strong objective evidence, there's also no particular reason to be suspicious. There's no particular reason why somebody would come to Indiana just because I want an Indiana driver's license. Here, we're talking about thousands over the 4 years. Tens of thousands of dollars will turn on this determination. So there's a strong incentive to lie. Right? Mm-hmm. So we've got no objective evidence to support the stated detention, and meaning from the fact of the move itself, and we have a problem here in terms of people's incentives not to tell the truth. So what we're looking for is something objective to replace the objective evidence you ordinarily have. And here, the university, very similar to these other regulations the Supreme Court has obviously said are okay, is give us a reason why you're in the state today, and other than attending the university, that if you were not admitted, if you were not currently enrolled, you would be here nevertheless. That is the standard, and it is clearly not unconstitutional.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Fickle. Mr. Porco, how much time does he have? 2 minutes? Okay, you have anything further?
Your Honor, first I would like to address one thing of particular importance, I believe. In my briefs, I detailed how you can't treat people who are actually legal residents.
Well, look, Mr. Porco, you're facing a very serious jurisdictional problem. If you don't have a response to Mr. Fickle's comment about when costs can be awarded, we have to dismiss the appeal.
I believe I addressed that. I guess I did not. The case I had cited had mentioned that. What's she referring to exactly? The case I had cited, or the?
Look, you didn't ask for injunctive relief. You can't get monetary relief. it looks as if you cannot benefit from this judgment. Now, what Mr. Fickle said is, if you had obtained injunctive relief against the state, you would be able to get costs, even though the costs represent, you know, a monetary exaction from the state. So there's a little 11th Amendment exception for costs when you get injunctive relief. But you didn't get injunctive. You didn't seek injunctive relief. So he's saying you have no basis for costs. Costs are just ancillary to injunctive relief.
Okay. Along with that, what I was arguing also was that the district court...
not an also. Do you have any response to that point? He says you can only get costs as ancillary relief if you get an injunction. You don't get injunction, you don't get costs. Now, is that wrong?
I guess it's an accurate statement, but what I'm saying is that I was seeking
an
injunction.
So you accept that. Now what do you want to say?
Well, I'm saying that I was seeking an injunction. So,
well, you didn't get it. You don't get costs when you don't get the injunction. The other side gets costs.
Right. So what I'm arguing is that the district court erred by, first of all, denying my request for summary judgment and granting theirs.
What does that have to do with the relief you're seeking?
The relief of costs?
Look,
relief?
You didn't get an injunction. You can't get money. So what is your basis for thinking you can get costs? If you don't get any relief that you seek, how can you get costs?
Well, in my
that's for the winning party. You got to win something.
Well, in my complaint, I not only sought injunctive relief; it was also declaratory relief.
You didn't get injunctive relief. Declaratory relief would do you zero good because you couldn't convert it to an injunction. You couldn't get your tuition back. So how can you possibly have a successful outcome to this litigation that would entitle you to cost?
It also argued that the motion for stay should have been granted and the clerk's action should have been rescinded.
Stay what?
The motion for stay that I filed after the judgment was executed unknowingly on my part. I was also arguing that it was error for the court to not rescind the action of the clerk.
So you're complaining, okay, you moved to stay what? To stay the payment of the tuition to the state.
Right.
Right?
I filed it just...
Now, are you appealing from the denial of that motion? Is that part of your appeal?
Yes. See, my time has expired. Thank you,
Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Porco and Mr. Fickle. So our next case...